Thank you very much, Saraha, for that very Saraha introduction. Very lovely. So some months ago, Damien, does everybody know Damien here? You probably all do, don't you? He wrote to me asking him if I would come to the centre here to give a talk, and he told me the theme must be related to a new initiative, a new project in the Birmingham Buddhist Centre, an outreach project, a project to take the Dharma out well beyond the Birmingham Buddhist Centre to more people in throughout the whole of Birmingham, different areas of Birmingham, throughout the Midlands, and perhaps even beyond. And Damien is very keen on this, and is very practically involved in it. And I more or less immediately said yes when I received an email from him. Partly because it was a good excuse to come to the centre again and see old friends in Birmingham. But there was another reason, perhaps a deeper and stronger motivation. Taking the Dharma out beyond the centre is just basically a fantastic, wonderful, inspiring project. To have that as a project that everybody in a Buddhist centre can be involved in is just so good. Good for everybody. There couldn't really be a better project, actually, a more important project than taking the Dharma out more and more widely, taking the Buddha's teaching out. And I say that with some feeling because the whole course of my life was changed by someone who took the Dharma out into new, uncharted territory. If he hadn't, well, it's very unlikely that I'd be here tonight speaking to you. So I want to be a bit personal for a while and tell you about how I came across Buddhism. I came across Buddhism when I was about 16. I was living in a village with my parents just outside of Brighton. And when I was about 14 or 15, I had some experiences, ecstasies, inspirations, deeper musing, amidst all the confusion of adolescence, of course. But I had, you know, these things happened. It was as if something was breaking through, breaking in, telling me very strongly, actually, that there was much more to this life than what was on offer from, let's call it, conventional society. There was a deeper reality, a deeper mystery to discover, to enter into, to dwell in, to live for. That's how it felt. Somehow, at 16, I knew I had to find out about Buddhism for various reasons. There were various sort of links in the chain about that. But I knew I had to read about Buddhism. And I got hold of my first Buddhist books in this really great bookshop that some sort of ex-hippies run in Brighton. And these were Lama Govinda's books, Lama Anagarika Govinda's book, the great German Buddhist, a friend of Sangharakshita, our founder. Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism, that was the first book I read. And then I read Way of the White Clouds. And these were completely thrilling books to me, utterly thrilling, tremendously inspiring. Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism I didn't understand, but I loved it. I love things I don't understand. And I loved it because there was something really clear, even though I didn't understand it. What was clear was there are higher states of consciousness. So there I am sitting in a semi-detached on a housing estate in this village in Sussex, discovering, blimey, incredible, there is a whole realm of incredible states of consciousness. A whole ascending realm, attainable, realizable, available to us, to me, and incredibly, fantastically, there's no God, there's no creator, which I'd never believed in, even though I was brought up as a Christian. So there was no limit to all this, no limit to this expanding consciousness. What I was being offered, what I felt in this book, was a spiritual life without limit, attainable particularly through meditation. That's what I got from that book. And then I read Lama Govinda's The Way of the White Clouds, which is really just an incredibly beautiful book. It's about Lama Govinda's journeys in Tibet, meeting lamas, meeting gurus, receiving initiation, having all sorts of visionary experiences. And it made it very clear to me, this book, that I needed to find a teacher, a Buddhist teacher, to spark me off, to initiate me, and to teach me meditation. But where would I find such a teacher? I mean, there were none in my village. Those days there was no Buddhist centre in Brighton. There was very little visible Buddhism. Very little visible Buddhism. You just kind of heard rumours that there was, for example, a Tibetan monastery in Scotland and things like that. And I can remember feeling at 16, 17, this intense longing to lead a Buddhist life and to find a teacher. I can remember I used to, it sounds really ridiculous, but there was a really nice photo of Lama Govinda on the cover of The Way of the White Clouds. And I used to meditate on it. I used to sort of sit cross-legged in my bedroom, just looking at this picture, sort of hoping something would happen. Maybe it did. Anyway, one day when I was 17, I was visiting the local hippie shop in Brighton, where I used to go and buy incense and poster reproductions of Tibetan tankers, which I put on the wall of my bedroom. And I noticed on this notice board, in a very small handwritten notice, I mean it was about that big, just written in somebody's handwriting, and it said, "The Friends of the Western Buddhist Order," which I thought was an incredibly boring name. I thought that was the old name of our movement, by the way. "The Friends of the Western Buddhist Order." So they couldn't be real Buddhists, they were just friends of, you know. Buddhists, yeah. "Friends of the Western Buddhist Order were thinking of starting..." It was all very English, the way it was put. "Friends of the Western Buddhist Order are thinking of starting a centre. If you're interested, come to this address," which was a house in a suburb outside Brighton. And immediately I went along. I had to go. And I met these really friendly people, the family that owned this house. They were lovely people and they were very welcoming. And they said, "Look, come back in a few days. And there's this man here named Buddhadasa, and he's running classes here. And come to his weekly class and, you know, you'll be able to go from there." And, you know, those days between going there and I'm going to meet my guru, you know, and I'm going to meet my teacher, and he's, you know, he's going to be wearing red robes and all this sort of thing. I was a bit disappointed when I met Buddhadasa. He didn't have robes, he didn't have a beard, he didn't have a hat. He was wearing jeans, you know, Levi's and a jumper. And he was quite young, actually. But that evening changed the whole course of my life. It was a sort of Sangha night, actually. There were about 10 people in the living room of this house, where there was a shrine room. And I got my first meditation instruction, Metta-bhavana. That was the first night. Very glad it was the Metta-bhavana, because there was something to do. I don't think I could have done the mindfulness of breathing. Found it very difficult to sit. You know, I tried to sit in full lotus, which is a bit of a joke. But I did get instruction in the Metta-bhavana. And then we did a puja, sevenfold puja, devotional practice. No explanation. Straight in, first night for me. Fantastic. That's exactly what I wanted. Strangely, weirdly, I don't know how this happened. I mean, I just loved the puja. I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted all the sort of magic and mystery. But weirdly, when we were chanting the mantras at the end, I just knew that I would devote my life to the Dharma, to Buddhism. I even knew that I'd be an order member. I'd only met one about an hour before. I don't know how I knew or why, I just knew. And well, that's what happened. So I'm incredibly grateful to Buddhadasa for his outreach work. In those days, there were just three city centres in our movement. There was one in London, in North London, in Archway, in North London. It's quite different from the North London centre now, where I eventually moved a bit later on. There was one in Glasgow, And there was one in Auckland, in New Zealand. That was it. But Adasa had been very involved in building up the North London Centre and very active in the early movement in London. And he then went off on a six-month solitary retreat on the Applecross Peninsula in the north of Scotland. And after that, he just decided that he wanted to take the Dharma out. And so he went to Brighton. So he was quite a pioneer. And he's actually done that a lot. I think he's probably started more centres than any other order member, you know, in different parts of the world. And he's a spiritual friend of mine. And I'm very grateful to him. What was interesting in Brighton was that he was so effective very quickly. There was a thriving sangha. And I have very, very fond memories of that sangha, that spiritual community. So you can see why an outreach project is so dear to me. And the thing is, I don't think I'm remarkable. I think this is quite important. Sometimes people are quite amazed when I tell my story and how I got involved so young and how I became ordained so young. I was ordained when I was 19, a couple of years after getting involved. But actually, I'm not at all special. And sometimes people think, oh, you must be a very spiritual person. I mean, actually, that's a bit of a joke. I'm definitely not. I'm a very ordinary, earthbound kind of person. You know, when I go, I love football, you know, love mucking about, music, food, playing around, sensuality, all the rest of it. The thing is, I reckon there are just loads of people like me, very ordinary, very human people, but with very, very deep spiritual longings, existential longings. There's loads of us out there, longings for the mystery, longings who long to get to grips with this life, who feel on occasions an urgency, an imperative to break out of this ready-made world and life that's been sort of handed to them. But they're perishing, they're wasting, as the old Buddhist text put it, through not meeting people who can show them the Dharma, who can show them a coherent, consistent, practical path, a way. There are loads of people, I think, that who sense an emerging potential, or if you like, an emerging energy within them, within life, but they just don't get the opportunity to really do something with it, because they don't meet people who feel the same way and who can offer them a clear and practical way of living from that potential, living from that energy, expressing that energy, if you like. I mentioned just then that in the old Buddhist text, very early Buddhist text, people are described as perishing or as wasting away because they've not heard the Dharma. This is very strong language indeed. And some people might think that it's a bit over the top, a bit heavy. But it's not really. In fact, it's this suffering, the deep existential suffering, this deep dissatisfaction and longing for liberation that the Buddha's love and compassion responds to more than anything. More than anything. I've used that word compassion there. It's a really loaded word, I think, for us. It's a difficult word. It's a problematic word. It's a word that's very easy to misunderstand. And we know that there's great emphasis in Buddhism on compassion. Wisdom and compassion, the two, you know, the twin wings of enlightenment. But people say sometimes, well, if you Buddhists emphasize compassion so much, why don't you go and feed the hungry? Why don't you do something to house the homeless, care for the sick, the elderly, work more for the preservation of our environment and so on? Why don't you do this? Well, of course, individual Buddhists do this kind of work in all sorts of fields, even come together to do this work. We can't ignore these things, these terrible sufferings in the world, overwhelming sufferings in the world. Sometimes these sufferings are so overwhelming to us, and especially with, you know, the effect of 24-hour media, you know, coming at us from every direction. Sometimes we can be so overwhelmed we just don't know what to do, how to act, and just are weighed down with anxiety and stress. But we need to ask, what was the nature of the Buddha's compassion? What was the essential nature of it? We know the Buddha's compassion could be incredibly immediate and practical. There are stories, a very famous story, where he comes across a sick monk, you know, who's fallen down in his filth because he's got dysentery and he's neglected by his monk friends, and the Buddha immediately goes to him and cleans him and with ananda washes him and puts him on a bed and tends him and so on, and tells the monks very, very strongly, "Monks, you have no father and mother to look after you. If you do not look after each other, then who will look after you?" Very strong language. But to get a fuller sense, if you like, of the sort of basic nature of the Buddha's compassion, we have to go back to a very, very famous incident in the Buddha's enlightenment, or just after his enlightenment, really an essential part of his enlightenment. It's a vision that you've probably heard quoted many times, but I never tire of reflecting on this vision. It's said that the Buddha looked out on the world, on human beings, on living beings. And he looked not with his sort of human eye, not even with the eye of meditation, not with a sort of even philosophical eye. He looked with his Buddha eye, his enlightened vision. This is a very, very important detail because it means he's seeing reality. He's seeing the actual nature of living beings. If you like, for want of a better way of putting it, their essential nature. And it's quite clear that he can only describe that using a metaphor. You know, if the Buddha is seeing with his enlightened eye, that means really it's something beyond words and language. It's, you know, in a way seeing us stripped of all kind of concept and so on, seeing us directly as we really are. And what he saw, the way he described this, was in terms of a great lake, a great muddy, dark lake, a lotus lake. And lotus lakes in India, if you've ever seen them in India, they really are incredible because lotuses seem to sort of grow up and thrive in the darkest, most sort of viscous, you know, really muddy, filthy ponds. So he saw living beings as lotuses thrusting up out of the lake. And I can remember, you know, coming across lotus lakes. I remember I was on a walk somewhere in the hills around Pune, where I lived at one time, and coming across this really filthy, muddy, hellish pool, a real slough of despond. And these lotuses, really strong, were coming out of it. And they're kind of lotuses. These were a particular shade of pink, a very deep pink. And they're kind of luminous lotus flowers. And very, very strong. Almost miraculous. Almost sort of, you know, like seeing grace or something like that, transforming this nasty environment. Well, the Buddha was seeing living beings like that. We are like that. We're essentially growing, emerging beings. He saw some beings with their buds tightly closed in the mud, and others lifting up, opening. So he saw us as essentially growing beings, growing to enlightenment, growing to liberation. And he saw this, saw us with a particular, the words aren't right here, feeling, mood, emotion, what do you call it? Which is usually, in the translations, translated as compassion. Sometimes it's translated as sympathy. None of them really quite do. The Pali word is a lovely word, and friends of mine will know that I go on about this all the time. But the Pali word is anukampa. Anukampa, which means to quake with, to tremble with, to shake with. So the Buddha's compassion, his love, his sympathy, is his fully developed humanity, his enlightened being, trembling with, shaking with, quaking with, resonating with, the potential for enlightenment emerging in others, emerging in life, in everybody, in all beings. So the Buddha's compassion isn't sorrow at the suffering of others. It's much more like a vital, living responsiveness to the emerging liberated energy in others, in us. So it's a completely positive vision of life, of us. And people suffer because they don't live from what is deepest in them, what is deepest in life. They even inflict sufferings on others because they don't live from what is deepest in them, and they don't see what is deepest in others. And this vision of the Buddha was not in any way vague or woolly. It's obviously some sort of, as it were, mystical or transcendental vision. But when he comes out of it and he reflects on who he's going to communicate to, he gets very specific. He gets right down to actual people and individuals. You know, sometimes you can see it at the end of the Metta Bhavana. If you open your eyes sometimes and look around the room, in the first four stages, people are sort of, struggling a bit. Last stage, when humanity is an abstraction, you see them blissing out, which is very interesting. But the Buddha doesn't just have the great, broad, deep vision. He also has practical awareness. He sees actual qualities, even if others can't. So after this great vision, he reflects, who will I teach? Who can I reach into? Who can I touch? And he recalled his old ascetic friends who he'd been practicing austerities with and who'd left him in disgust when he had a bowl of rice. And he reflected, very simple his reflection, they were very helpful to me. They were very helpful to me. They were my friends. They were friendly. They will see what I have seen. I can show them. I can show them the Dharma. So he saw their quality. He was aware of their quality. He saw their ordinary human qualities. And it's in our ordinary human qualities that our potential for enlightenment, for liberation, it's there that our potential for enlightenment can be found. And it's in ordinary human qualities that we can all contribute to taking the Dharma out to others. Sometimes people think that unless you are a highly spiritually developed person, you cannot make the Dharma known to others. You shouldn't make it known. You shouldn't teach because you might lead people astray. Oh dear. But in taking the Dharma out, in making it known, we're not talking about being a great spiritual teacher. And we're not talking about adopting some sort of position or role as teacher. It's nothing like that at all. What we're talking about is a community. A spiritual community. A community of friends, in the widest sense, sharing itself. Sharing its deepest values and ideals, and sharing its knowledge and its practices, sharing its experience, sharing its culture with more and more people. A community sharing itself well beyond, for example, this rich and uplifting environment of the centre. And it really is a rich and uplifting environment here in this centre. And we need environments to live a spiritual life, to lead a Dharma life. Environments are incredibly important. I mean, just coming in here, I felt it this evening, coming in, I haven't been here for a while. It's immediately uplifting to walk through the door because the whole place is imbued with spiritual friendship, with spiritual community. And that's as important as the Dharma teaching as the meditation practice is. Dharma is in the air, in the atmosphere here. Outreach work, taking the Dharma out, is really taking that environment, taking that atmosphere out into the city, out to the towns and villages all around. And we do that through developing together distinctively human qualities. Human qualities which in time become, through our practice, bodhisattva qualities. Bodhisattvas, this is the term for those who are, you know, fully committed, well on the way to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all. So those bodhisattva qualities come out of human qualities. Now there are many qualities we could go through for taking the Dharma out, but I want to explore in particular a very famous and important teaching called the Four Sangraha Vastus. The four ways of gathering a community. Even the four ways of gathering friends, creating a community, widening a community, but it also has the meaning of maintaining and invigorating a community, even unifying and harmonising a community. And this teaching of the Sangraha Vastus was developed very strongly in that great tradition of Buddhism known as the Mahayana, the Great Way. But it's actually taught by the Buddha in the old earliest Pali text, and it taught somebody called Hataka, who was a leading lay disciple, very highly developed, irreversible from enlightenment lay disciple, who was famous for gathering around him and creating a large spiritual community of highly developed individuals. Very interesting story about him, but I haven't got time to dwell on him. You'll have to look him up. So the four Sangraha Vastus are first of all generosity, secondly loving speech, thirdly living meaningfully, and fourthly exemplification. And I'm going to look at these and see how they might apply to outreach work. So first of all, generosity, dana. You know this one. I'm sure you've had innumerable dana appeals at the centre. Appeals for funds and giving of time and energy for the centre. Well, obviously, taking the Dharma out will involve much generosity in all kinds of ways. If you want to get involved in, you know, outreach work, you know, you need to give your time, your energy, money. It's all useful. Helping practically. Helping to find good venues to hold a course or a class in. Transport, offering transport, creating a good environment if you go and hire a hall or something like that, organising cushions and all that sort of thing. It really comes down to that. And generosity like this in terms of outreach work can lead to real ingenuity. I lived in India for many years doing Buddhist work there with the Buddhist community, the many thousands of Buddhists who converted to Buddhism in the late 50s, who came from the lowest strata of Indian society as a way of liberation. I might say more about that in a minute. But in the very, I was there in the very early days when we were setting up activities there, and we didn't have a centre. We had very little money to hire a place, and we'd take classes and give talks. Well, anywhere, virtually. And our Indian friends would be so ingenious about getting places. So we used to do a Sunday morning class, or we organised a Sunday morning class. And some of our friends arranged for us to have a class in a garage. This was a Christian family. The people's garage we were using. We could use the garage because the car was out Sundays to take them to church. And the story goes, I heard a rumour one of our older members just went up to these people because he knew them and said, look, can we use your garage to hold meditation classes, Buddhism classes? And they said, yes, providing providing you encourage birth control. I didn't hear anything about that. And they just said, oh yes, of course, you know. Anyway, that garage used to be packed, you know, and it was really hot in the middle of the day. But we had really terrific Sunday morning classes there. And the word went round. It was sort of everybody squeezing in the garage and spilling out into the courtyard. And we had some really good classes there. Or we used to kind of squat the veranda of a disused bungalow. This bungalow wasn't used. And one of our Indian friends kind of persuaded the chowkidar, the watchman, that how about letting us use the veranda for a bit of Buddhism? So we'd just go in and hold a class there. I'm not suggesting you go squatting in Birmingham. I'm just being genius. But with these places, it was great because such a strong feeling built up. It was a real adventure. And of course, because everybody was Buddhists and were very interested, a lot of people came along. But afterwards, we'd often go for lunch with the families, you know, in people's houses. And there was a very strong sense of sharing things, with one another. And this was really infectious, actually. So there was this generous atmosphere, and our own, if you like, generosity, sharing the Dharma, was begetting generosity in the people around. I mean, Indian people, of course, are extraordinarily generous and hospitable. But it kind of took off, if you like. And so the generosity I'm talking about is not for favour or to win friends and influence people, but it comes out of abundance. You feel a richness in yourself. You feel that living spiritual potential, if you like, and you want to share it. And you want to please and delight others. So this kind of sharing is infectious. And when people see a community of friends doing it, being generous with one another, being generous with their time and energy and even with food and things like that, they want to join in. I was at an outreach group in Chesterfield recently. It was a lovely place. It was a 14th century chapel that had been turned into a little community centre that they found. And those coming along, it became a bit of a thing. People, quite new people, this sort of people were bringing baking cakes and sharing them with everybody, which I think is fantastic. So after the meditation and discussion, you know, there was sharing of food and all that sort of thing. It might sound trivial, that, but it really isn't. There's something very deeply human about that. Sharing, you know, what is good with one another. That's as important as the Dharma teaching. So generosity. And then there's loving speech. Priyavadita. Speech. Communication. That's loving and affectionate. This word priya is a very strong word in Indian language, meaning somebody who's very, very, very dear to you. It's not superficially calling everybody darling and dear and sweetie pops and all that sort of thing. I mean, they could be expressions of the real thing, but not necessarily. It's communication. I gave myself away then, didn't I? sweetie pops. It's communication that arises out of a rich awareness of others. A rich awareness of others. Sangharakshita defines love in one of his lectures as awareness of the being of another. That's real love. Awareness of another's being. Fully taking someone in all their reality. Listening to them. And responding to them with kindness. And then being kind in your communication with them. And this, of course, in an outreach group, this can be between those in the group, the team, that is taking the Dharma out. In fact, it's really crucial that that's there. In the team, there should be real affection. And in fact, the affection grows if you get involved in a project like that. A delighted affection for one another. And that's expressed in the team. Enjoying one another. Because you enjoy the Dharma, you enjoy one another, taking the Dharma out. So there's a strong harmony and a real playfulness. Playfulness, really important in outreach work, a playful attitude. Again, a little reference to India. I lived for some time in Bombay. We had no centre. We just had a small flat for classes, not that far from the main airport. And you know, that's where I lived. But the rest of the time, in the evenings, we'd go out to Buddhist areas. We'd go out to Buddha Nagar and Jai Bhim Nagar and Siddharth Nagar and Ramabai Nagar. Literally, there are thousands of these areas which are Buddhist. And a lot of them are what we would call real slums. But they're people's homes, communities. We'd go all over Bombay as much as we could. You know, four or five nights a week, actually. And we went as a team. There was me and there were the older members and mitras and friends in the Bombay Sangha. Who were all, you know, working very hard in their day jobs and had families and all the rest of it. But we'd go out as a group. And we really enjoyed one another. We really loved one another. There wasn't just a good harmony between us, but a lot of fun. A lot of humour. And we'd make sure that we all did different things. So there was me giving a talk, there was my translator, an amazing order member named Bodhi Sen. Somebody else would, you know, because it was a Buddhist event, somebody else would lead the refuges and precepts, and somebody else would introduce and so on. And I realised on one of these occasions that, well, the talk I gave, and more particularly the way it was translated, Bodhi Sen was a fabulous communicator in Marathi, the local language, that was important. But what was even more important was people getting the vision of a happy and loving community of friends. That was actually more important, I would say. They were seeing Dharma in practice, visible Dharma, visible here and now. They were seeing the metta bhavana. They were seeing the precepts in action. They saw that we didn't have barriers between us. And, so they really picked up on that. And then, of course, to those coming along, you know, if we're in an outreach team, or if we're in a team running a class for that matter, of course we need to practice loving speech. Being really friendly and welcoming. Maybe not too friendly, because especially with the English, you know, that might freak them. But being friendly, welcoming, courteous, interested in them, putting them at their ease, letting them know what's going to happen, letting them know where the different things are. It's a big thing for them to come along. Remember the first time you maybe came along to a class, maybe you felt really nervous and shy and awkward. Well, they're going to be like that. You know, there's that weird thing. I don't know if you feel it. Here's a confession. Have you ever had that thing where you're at a class, if you're more of a regular, and somebody's coming along, they feel shy and awkward, and you do too, and you sort of go and be friendly, and you feel I don't quite know what to say. Is that just me? Moving on. I remember there was a man who used to come along to the centre when I was at Croydon. And he came to the beginner's class, and I would talk to him every week. And he really was painfully shy. I mean, you know, really trying to hide behind his teacup, you know, behind the bookshelf and all the rest of it. But I thought it was really important that I just went and said hello to him every week. And of course, I felt awkward as well after a while, and, you know, eventually I'd sort of go away and talk to somebody else. But he told me years later that that was so important for him. It made all the difference that I just made a point of talking to him. And, well, he's now one of our order members. So we can show a real interest in the people coming along, not as a tactic, but because of this anukampa I've talked about, this resonating with others, and really finding, really learning to see that other people are really fascinating, actually always fascinating. And of course, it's a practice, this loving speech, this coming into communication with others. It's a mindfulness of others. There's a lot of talk about mindfulness these days, but we need to remember that it's not just mindfulness of ourselves. We need to be mindful of others and really take others in. That's the way we expand our consciousness. And if you're not an order member involved in any kind of outreach team, that's a really good thing. That's a really brilliant thing, because people coming along, new people coming along, might find you much more approachable than the person wearing the funny white thing with the funny white name, funny sounding name. Yeah, so, you know, you can make a real contribution there. So, loving speech. Then thirdly, there's living meaningfully. Artacharya in Sanskrit, which could be translated as well as living for the good. And this is explained in some Buddhist texts as communicating the Dharma, teaching the Dharma. That's what living meaningfully really is. But the implication is, of course, that to communicate the Dharma, you have to live it, and you have to practice it. Only then can you teach it. Which means, of course, if you're going to get involved in teaching the Dharma, you need to study the Dharma, you need to reflect on the Dharma, you need to know it, you need to practice it in ethics, in behaviour, in meditation. Then you can communicate it, teach it. Not everybody involved in outreach work will be able to do this formally at first. And there's certainly things you can do in conversation and things like that to help clarify for things for people. But it's usually just the order members. It might be others sometimes. Maybe somebody's sick and so on. But it's usually the order members who do the formal teaching. But sometimes, yes, you might be asked to step in. You might be a new order member. You might not be an order member. And you get a phone call. We've got the course tonight. Somebody's sick. You're going to have to do something. So be ready. In the early days of our Sangha, of our movement, Sangha Akshita said every order member needs to be ready to give 3 talks at the drop of a hat. Because you don't know when you're going to get the call. The Rotary Club phones up, you might have to go and give a talk. Your old school phones up, you might have to give a talk. Somebody's sick, you might have to give a talk. So the 3 subjects, the Buddha and Buddhism, meditation, and a kind of topic of your own choosing, just so that you can let rip, but be careful with that last one. But particularly, the Buddha and Buddhism and meditation. So get your talks ready now. Start getting them ready. And preparing a talk is a really brilliant thing to do, because it helps you to learn. It clarifies things for you. It objectifies what you know. You also find out what you don't know as well. I mean, I do, you know, if I want to study something, because I live at a retreat centre and I've got all these people around that I can experiment on, if I want to study something for myself, I say, right, I'm going to lead a study group. Or I'll run a retreat on it. Then I can prepare it. It's a neat trick. So preparing a talk is a really good thing. So, I mean, I really would recommend it, even if you're quite new to Buddhism and you're still learning it. Imagine giving a talk to, I don't know, your friends. How are you going to do that? How are you going to put that? How are you going to explain it? So I'm going to mention 4 things that really need to go into a good Dharma talk. First of all, clarity. Any kind of presentation of the Dharma, meditation, whatever, you need to be clear. The whole presentation needs to hold together. It needs to make sense. It needs to be clearly delivered as well. Don't mumble. Don't, you know, this is a really important thing. Some people are very unconfident and they tend to mumble. They don't kind of, you know, let rip. But, you know, if you're going to communicate, get it out there. Project, as well as putting it together very clearly. So clarity. Secondly, it needs to be emotionally resonant. You know, rich with metaphor, simile, stories, examples. People remember the stories. You can listen to a talk for an hour and just go away with one story. Great, you know, and because that's communicating to you, that's touching you. So emotionally resonant. Thirdly, it needs to be practical. It must be something that people can use right now in their lives. Something that will help them develop and change and move along in the Dharma. And fourthly, a Dharma talk needs to be congruent, suited to the people that you're actually talking to, in tune with them. So that means you need to be aware of the atmosphere around you and a general awareness of life and how and what's going on in life right now. I must admit, when I was first in India doing outreach work, it took me a while to be congruent. I still tended to teach meditation and Buddhism as I was doing it in 1970s London, in West London and North London. You know, and you can imagine the sort of language of 1970s London, be it kind of, you know, psychological, you know, whatever, mystical, I don't know. Can't remember now. It was a long time ago. In India, I always had a feeling I just wasn't getting through. It wasn't just that, you know, I couldn't speak Marathi and I was having to use an interpreter. That wasn't it. It was something else. Even though I'd immersed myself in the study of the life of their great leader, Dr. Ambedkar, and all that sort of thing. One day, I had to go to the dentist in India. And I was waiting in the waiting room. And I noticed all these film magazines that you used to get in those days. I think you can still get them. All about the Bollywood film world. And I kind of looked through them and read them. They were sort of fascinating in a sort of way. Something must have happened anyway. Because not long after that, in the question and answer session after meditation, I got a question, you know, what's the best way to prepare for meditation? So I talked about, you know, the usual things and, you know, maybe not being too excited before meditation. I said, look, it'd probably be difficult to meditate after you've been to a Bollywood movie because your mind be full of Amitabh Bachchan and Parveen Barbi and Shashi Kapoor and Dharmendra, and everybody fell about laughing. And I thought, right, that's what you do. I mean, it's one of those moments. I mean, it might sound really mundane, but it's important. You need to be in touch with what's going on for people. Also, don't underestimate people in terms of congruency. There will be people who want to know if you're in touch with the Dharma in the most profound sense. You know, a lot of people come along to Buddhism quite rightly to meditation because they want to de-stress. You know, they want to relax. They want to, you know, sort themselves out sort of psychologically and so on. Of course, that's, you know, part of, you know, the deal, so to speak. We need to relate to that. But there are people who want to know if you are really in touch with something, yes, mysterious, transcendental. Well, that's what I wanted. It was, thankfully, Buddhadasa did a puja. So don't underestimate people. Don't underestimate, in a way, really showing the Dharma in its fullness. And you can do that without, you know, alienating people. I was really amazed once with Sangharakshita, our founder, when he came to India, when we were first there. He was giving a lecture to a few thousand people in an open air. It was an open air lecture, so a lot of these people had, you know, there were educated people there, but a lot of people who hadn't had much education, probably people there illiterate. And he started a talk by talking about the Yogacara system of consciousness. this Yogacara was a school of Mahayana Buddhism that had a highly sophisticated analysis of consciousness, saying that we have no less than 8 different consciousnesses. So the 5 sense consciousness, then the, as it were, the ordinary mind consciousness, and then a deep consciousness, the 8th, which is called the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness that stores all the seeds of our actions. And then in between the Alaya Vijnana and our ordinary mind is a consciousness called the Klishtomano Vijnana, the defiled mind consciousness. And this consciousness is defiled in a particular way. It's the consciousness that sets up a division between self and other, which in reality isn't really there. A division between self and other, a fixed self and other. Basic kind of problem. So I thought, as he's explaining this, I thought, and everybody's gripped. This whole audience is completely gripped. He's right in tune. But I thought, where's he going? Where's he going with this? Where are we going to end up? Are we going to end up in some weird metaphysical space? What's going to happen? And then when he started to talk about this discriminating consciousness, he said, and this is where caste comes from. This is where untouchability comes from. It was an amazing moment. He's basically saying the social and political and religious problems, the communal problems of India, of the world, is found in consciousness. It's found in the depths of consciousness. And that's why we need Dharma to transform the depth of consciousness, to transform the world. And people were right in there. So you can take any Dharma teaching, and you relate it to people's actual living experience. And the Buddha, of course, is the supreme example of congruency. His sympathy, his empathy, his anukampa is highly attuned. He's highly resonant with others, with all others. There's a beautiful, mysterious passage in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha. It's the last days, the Parinirvana, apparently the Buddha's moving on to his Parinirvana, his passing. And there's this set of quite mysterious conversations with Ananda, his chief disciple. And the Buddha suddenly explains to Ananda that there are 7 assemblies, 7 gatherings, 7 groups of people. There are warriors, there are Brahmins, that's the priests, there are householders, there are wandering renunciates. He even mentions gatherings of different god realms. And the Buddha said, I have attended hundreds of these gatherings, and I've sat with the people, the beings in these gatherings, and I communicated with them. I discussed with them. I adopted their dress, and I adopted their language. I taught them the Dharma, so that they were established in the Dharma, so that they could practice the Dharma, and they became filled with gladness and enthusiasm to practice the Dharma. And then the Buddha mysteriously adds, they did not know who was speaking. Is this a human being? Is this a god? And once they were established in the practice, I vanished. And they were left wondering, who was that? What was that? It's a very mysterious passage indeed. And on one level, it's a description of real anukampa, this shaking with, this resonating with others. It's describing egoless communication of the Dharma. You're completely in tune with the Dharma, and you're completely in tune with the people you're communicating to. I adopted their dress, their voice, their language. And the people wonder at who they are in touch with. What kind of a being is this? And perhaps, even with our own much humbler efforts to communicate the Dharma, to share the Dharma, perhaps at times there's a flavour of what the Buddha is talking about. Perhaps there are times and moments when the Dharma is strongly, vividly alive. The team running the class, the group, the outreach group, are deeply in tune with one another and deeply in tune with the people coming along. And the Dharma is resonant and clear. And there is a magic in there, an extra special something, even a kind of ecstasy, a moving outside of ourselves. So that later on, we might think as we leave the class and as we go home, what was that? Who was that? Fourthly, there's exemplification. Samanartata, being an example, embodying what you are communicating. You know, if you're communicating the metta bhavana, the precepts, well, you're practicing it. You're not just teaching it, you're doing it. So this will mean things like making sure that you're in a good state, a positive state, when you go to the outreach group, when you go to the class. Making sure that, you know, when you're with the team, you're making an effort to be in harmony with one another. It's why doing this kind of thing, taking the Dharma out, is a very powerful practice. It inspires us to make an extra effort. Others, as it were, are drawing us out. It's not about putting on a show, exemplification, but wanting to really benefit others through your being, your behaviour. We're not, I should say, trying to exemplify perfection, because, let's face it, I don't know about you, we're not perfect. We're exemplifying effort to live the Dharma life. And people see our efforts and they're inspired by our efforts. Maybe even moved by our efforts to communicate the Dharma, and they want to get involved in that. What we exemplify is, a very good friend of mine often says, we exemplify being a mess in progress. So if you feel that you're a mess, that's fine, so long as you're in progress. And it's not just you personally, but the community, the team that is exemplifying. When people see a group of committed people changing through working on themselves, and they're committed to wider change, well, people are inspired and moved when they see that. They want to get up as well. They want to get out and involved in that as well. I've seen this. And again, I've seen it in this country, but I've seen it perhaps most dramatically in India, among the Buddhist, within the Buddhist community there. I mean, Dr. Ambedkar, Babasaheb Ambedkar, this great leader who came from what used to be called an untouchable community, they're now generally called Dalits, the downtrodden, he started this great conversion movement to Buddhism. He led hundreds of thousands of people into Buddhism. And Dr. Ambedkar himself, you know, became a great man through his tremendous efforts. He became the first law minister of India. He framed the Indian constitution. Man of extraordinary stature. And he realized that yes, there must be social, political, economic and educational change. Of course. There needed to be revolution. Non-violent revolution. There needed to be that kind of change in India. And he worked on all those levels. But very early on he saw that if there's going to be real, lasting, deep change, there has to be consciousness change. There has to be a revolution in the depths of the mind, where the deepest habits and forces of conditioning are. And that's why he chose Buddhism. He chose Buddhism because Buddhism is about that revolution in the depths. The Buddha Dharma is a revolution in the depths. And it supports the revolution in the world. They support each other. The revolution in the depths of the mind of the individual and the revolution in the world. And in India, I used to see the most extraordinary things. I remember in Bombay, in our community, people would get more involved with us, more committed. And before they came along, they were alcoholic, dissolute, violent, very bad to their wives, their children. They were doing soul-destroying work, travelling long distances every day for little money. And they'd come along, sometimes by chance. I mean, there's an amazing story of a drunk person somehow finding this Buddhist pamphlet, one of our publications, reading it completely off his head and thinking, wow, I've got to find this. And he's now one of our old members. And, you know, people like this would come along, they'd hear the Dharma, they'd meditate, they'd get involved. And almost overnight they'd stop doing all those things. You know, the drinking, the wife beating, you know, the depression, everything would go. And they would feel happy. And I remember talking to one of them, because there was no immediate economic change to his circumstances. He still had a soul-destroying, well, it wasn't a soul-destroying any job anymore, but a difficult job for little money, living in a slum. And I said, you know, what's the difference? He said, well, I'm living meaningfully now. I'm living meaningfully now. I have a sense of growth, of change. You know, because I can actually do something on my consciousness, and because I've found a real community of friends, a real sangha, I have a sense of liberation. And it's actually making me more able to deal with this situation so much more. And this gave me great faith in the power of the Dharma, seeing this. It's very moving indeed, seeing this. And of course, when people have that experience, and it's not just, I should just stress, it's not just having a kind of catechism, a set of beliefs. I'm talking about people doing real spiritual practice to get to this state. When they discover that, they just want to get out there and share it more widely, because they experience the change. Their families experience the change. So they want to get involved in the outreach work as well. And it's true here too. I've seen it so many times. Where I live at Padmaloka, I hear a lot of life stories. We have quite a lot of opportunities for people to tell their journeys. It's very, very instructive. And I have so many people that you know, they've... Okay, economically, they're, you know, much better off than people in India. But this, you know, awful kind of suffering that they've gone through to do with, you know, a lot of it is to do with meaning and the sort of casual cruelty that comes out of ignorance, you know, maybe in their families, maybe, you know, from circumstances. You know, you see people getting, have got squeezed into a position of real suffering, and they discover the Dharma and something changes. So this world needs the Dharma, needs to rise up in the Dharma. We need people to rise up in the Dharma. People want to rise up in the Dharma. And we need to take it out more with much greater imagination. Much greater imagination. And we're a very young Buddhist Sangha. It can all seem so established with a wonderful centre like this. But we're so young. And there's so many ways in which we could think about how to take the Dharma out. And we need to find a way of taking it out that is more direct, which is simpler and yet richer and more profound. That's what we've got to find, that reaches right into the heart of people, that connects with their deepest concerns and brings about the deepest possible change and transformation. We need to teach a Dharma that will bring about a shift away from excessive self preoccupation and polarization. A shift, if you like, to genuine selflessness. You know, we've been promised for so long in the West, you know, the quality of life, meaning the economic quality of life, is the promised land. Manifestly is not. Manifestly is not the promised land. That is not heaven. That will not satisfy, manifestly. So we've got to find a way of bringing the Dharma to people in this world. To bring about a shift to a genuine selflessness, to this anukampa. Actually, if we get into this anukampa, this profound shaking with others in love and real sympathy, well, that really will bring a real revolution in this deeply troubled world of ours. We need the lightning bolt of the Dharma. We need to find the way, the voice, in this time and place to say words like these, very familiar words. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Those who entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will still their hatred. Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. Others do not realize that we are all heading for death. Those who do realize it will end their quarrels. So thank you very much for inviting me to speak as part of your great project to take the Dharma out through this city, throughout the Midlands. I wish you every success with it.